Watchman's Teaching Letter, Volume 2, The Demise of Edom, Watchman's Teaching Letter Number 24, April 2000, from the 2000 Watchman's Teaching Letters by Clifton Emmeheiser, read by Dan Adams. This is the 24th monthly teaching letter which I have produced since I started publishing them May 1998. These teaching letters are written in such a manner as they won't go out of date, which is exactly why we decided to start recording readings of them, as their subject matter is of the timeless and eternal in significance. They will be just as relevant and pertinent any time in the future as they are at present. I am duty-bound by Yahweh's law to witness to the truth to the best of my ability, as I understand it. In other words, if I know a crime has been committed, is in the process of being committed, or there is a danger of a crime about to be committed, if I do not witness to what I know, I become as guilty as the person or persons committing the crime. We'll put in here, the common lawful equivalent is called misprision. This is something we think everyone needs to know about. Misprision, spelled M-I-S-P-R-I-S-I-O-N. And most of those masquerading as leaders of social or economic institutions throughout the empire presently ruling Jacob's progeny are, by their knowledge of it, complicit in criminal activity and are liable, under the definition of misprision, to prosecution for the crimes covered by their countless denials. Recall projection, another typical tool of their mind games, which is, oh, it's not my problem, it's yours. Returning to Clifton. In this case, we are not talking about a single individual crime. We are talking about tens of thousands of crimes. Everyone who understands the quote-unquote Jewish conspiracy has this same obligation. I go a step farther. I prove from the scriptures just who the enemy is and what his primary motive is. Some spiritually project this enemy 1,000 years into the future. But I maintain he is with us today. The news of these crimes has been withheld from the public by the usual news media and history writers of the past. The law concerning the witness of a crime is found in Leviticus 5:1, which reads, "And if a soul sin, and hear the voice of swearing, and is a witness whether he hath seen or known of it, if he do not utter it, then he shall bear his iniquity." And this happens to be the exact and precise definition of misprision. So this is not a human law. This is God's law. If we do not comply with this command, it becomes a very serious violation of Yahweh's law on our part. I, for one, do not want to be found equally guilty for another person's crime. A second scripture which commands us to expose the truth is found in Ephesians 5:11, which says, "And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them." The New Treasury of Scripture Knowledge, edited by Jerome H. Smith, says this on page 132, "Such as one shall bear his iniquity, shall be considered as guilty in the sight of God of the transgression which he has endeavored to conceal, and must expect to be punished for hiding the iniquity with which he was acquainted." At least some insist that the word iniquity implies something different from sin, yet both are willful acts in violation of God's law, which also happens to be the natural law, as it literally cannot be violated without serious consequences. Iniquity is said to be knowing beforehand that an action was wrong and doing it anyway, even encouraging others to do it. In the last letter, number 23, I started a series on the subject of Esau. In that lesson, I proved the passage in Deuteronomy 23:7 to be in error. As it turns out, it is the Syrian we are not to abhor, instead of the Edomite. Then I gave a general overview of the story of Esau. The demise of Edom. In the last lesson, I was explaining how Esau married three wives, a Hittite, a Hivite, and Ishmael's daughter. From these three wives, there came 14 dukes of Edom. I had a person bring to my attention that these Hittite and Hivite wives of Esau were descendants of Ham, and therefore they were white people. Now it is true that the Hittites are descendants of Heth, the second son of Canaan, Genesis 10:15, and therefore descendants of white Ham. The Hivites are somewhat similar and are of Canaan also, Genesis 10:16, the son of Ham by incest. You may wonder, what does Esau have to do with all this? In order to understand the relation of Esau to Canaan, the son of Ham, we really have to understand the origin of Canaan. If we don't have a good foundation for the genealogy of Esau to set all the building blocks in place, we will never understand his story in its proper sense. Canaan, born of incest. It all starts with the passage found in Genesis 9:22. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without. Ham had several other children that could have been mentioned in this verse, but why was Canaan singled out from the rest? There is a very good reason, for Ham, like Reuben later, had incest with his father's wife, or in other words, his mother. From this union, Canaan was born. This was the reason for the curse that Noah placed upon Canaan. Curses like these are very serious, as they will follow all the offspring of that person forever. This was no light matter. You will notice that none of the rest of Ham's children had a curse placed on them. We can prove that this is what happened in this passage of Scripture by referring to Leviticus 18:7 and 8. The nakedness of thy father, or the nakedness of thy mother, shalt thou not uncover. She is thy mother. Thou shalt not uncover her nakedness. The nakedness of thy father's wife shalt thou not uncover. It is thy father's nakedness. It was not Noah's personal nakedness that Ham looked upon, but the nakedness of his mother. Genesis 9:22 is a passage that, when you refer to the various commentaries, concordances, and dictionaries of the Bible, you will find nothing but confusion. But for the passage Leviticus 18:7-8, the commentators are a little more responsive. The Wycliffe Bible Commentary, page 99, has this to say about this passage. The nakedness of thy father. These laws were addressed to men. Hence, this verse contains a prohibition not against incest between father and daughter, but against incest between son and mother only. The shame brought upon the mother was brought also upon the father. As they were of one flesh, Genesis 2:24, any act committed against the mother could be considered to have been likewise committed against the father. End quote. One other thing should be mentioned here. The book of Genesis is not necessarily written entirely in chronological order. When Moses was recording all of this at a much later time, he was looking back at these things. Obviously, Noah didn't curse Canaan immediately on learning this incident with Ham, for at the time, he could not have known whether or not Ham had caused his mother to become pregnant. But somewhere in the space of time, probably at the birth of Canaan, Noah pronounced his curse. Because Genesis 2:24 is mentioned in this last reference, let's take a look at it and see what it has to say. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Flesh is the Hebrew word number 1320 in the Strong's exhaustive concordance of the Bible and is described as follows. From 1319, flesh, from its freshness, by extension body, person, also by euphemism, the pudenda of a man, body, fat, lean, flesh or fleshed, kin, mankind, plus nakedness, self, skin. Now let's check in the Reader's Digest Great Encyclopedic Dictionary to see the meaning of the word pudenda. You will find it spelled pudendum in most dictionaries. Pudendum, 1, the external genital parts of the female, vulva. 2. The external genital parts of either sex, Latin neuter of pudendus, gerundive of pudere, to be ashamed. I know this is sort of graphic, but I believe from all of this we can better understand what was involved concerning the episode when it says, "And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father." It's the Hebrew way of saying, he looked upon the nakedness of his mother, to prove that the word flesh can mean pudenda, or the genitals of both a male or female. I will cite the 2nd, 3rd, 7th, 13th, and 19th verses of the 15th chapter of Leviticus. Truly, you need to read the entire chapter. When any man hath a running issue out of his pudenda, and this shall be his uncleanness in his issue, whether his pudenda run with his issue, or his pudenda be stopped from his issue. And he that toucheth the pudenda of him that hath the issue, and bathe his pudenda in running water. And if a woman have an issue, and her issue in her pudenda be blood, you can see very clearly that we have to learn to read the scriptures in the correct context of their true setting, as the words being used may only be a substitution of a genteel expression for an unpleasant or offensive one. This is called a euphemism or genteelism. In other words, the word flesh is a euphemism and, in the case above, literally means the pudenda of a man or a woman. Now, many times we miss the entire meaning of passages, lacking understanding of an euphemism when we encounter it. If we understand these euphemisms, then we can understand why Adam and Eve were naked and were not ashamed. And later we can also understand what kind of quote-unquote aprons they made and what part of their body they were trying to hide. It's one thing to find the various Hebrew and Greek meanings of the words, but it is quite another thing to put them in their proper context with the scripture involved. In order to understand the context, one must have a working understanding of how any one passage fits with the rest of scripture. If one finds a conflict with other passages, his mental context has to be wrong. The above application is a good case in point. Noah's curse upon Canaan and all his descendants. By the actions of Ham, we find a curse placed by Noah, and Noah had every right to do so as the head of his family, upon the child Canaan and all his descendants forever, born of the incestuous union. Genesis 9:25. And he, Noah, said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." This was no idle threat against Canaan, for Yahweh had just caused a flood to eliminate this sort of thing. The reason the curse was on Canaan instead of Ham is because Canaan was the product of Ham's union with his mother. When we understand the nature of Noah's curse, we can then also understand why the other members of Noah's family would refuse to intermarry with Canaan's offspring. The only way Canaan could obtain a wife would be to take one of the non-Adamic heathen women in the area where they were dwelling. And this is just what Canaan and his descendants did. With this curse, Canaan and his descendants were effectively banished from the rest of the family. Momentarily put yourself in the place of the members of Noah's family. Would you want to marry your sons and daughters or grandsons and granddaughters to Canaan's issue, and thus they would come under Noah's curse also? While we are on the subject of Noah, let's take a look at what was going on just previous to the flood and Yahweh's reason for bringing it about. We will find it in the book of Jasher, which book is mentioned twice in our present Bibles, chapter 4, verse 18. And their judges and rulers went to the daughters of men and took their wives by force from their husbands, according to their choice. And the sons of men in those days took from the cattle of the earth, the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the air, and taught the mixture of animals of one species with the other, in order therewith to provoke the Lord. And God saw the whole earth, and it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted its ways upon earth, all men and all animals. This could give us some background on the reason for Noah's curse on Canaan. You have to understand that Noah and his family had witnessed all this interracial mixture and crossbreeding of the plants and animals. Noah had to make a very quick and hard judgment upon this situation to prevent it from happening again. You can be sure that the rest of the family of Noah sat up and took attentive notice of this pronounced curse upon Canaan, and reminded their children for many generations concerning this thing. But we have forgotten, for this is exactly the same thing we are witnessing in our own day. Not only do we have the intermarriage of the races, but the scientists are experimenting with genetic engineering. An article dated Saturday, January 29, 3:03 p.m. Eastern Time on Yahoo News, Associated Press, titled "Deal Reached on Biotech Foods," Montreal, AP, where the United Nations, the UN, is trying to produce rules governing genetically engineered products. I cannot go into all the details here, but on page 2 of this report it says, "Genetically modified crops are already widespread. About 70 million acres of genetically engineered plants were cultivated worldwide in 1999. In the United States, genetically engineered varieties account for about 25% of corn and 40% of soybeans." On page 1 of this report, it says, "The protocol is intended to protect the environment from damage due to genetically modified organisms. Environmentalists and some scientists worry that bioengineered plants, animals, and bacteria could wipe out native strains or spread their genetic advantages to weeds and other undesirable species. Their fish genes in fruit, poultry genes in fish, animal genes in plants, growth hormones in milk, insect genes in vegetables, tree genes in grain, and in the case of pork, human genes in meat," said Steve Gilman, an organic farmer in Stillwater, New York. "It seems there is nothing new under the sun." Where could Canaan have gotten a wife? It is obvious that Canaan could not have gotten a wife from Noah's family, with this curse upon him. Where, then, could Canaan have gotten his wife and or wives? For this, I'm going to quote the Holy Bible in Modern English by Ferrer Fenton, Genesis 10:5, 20, and 31. "From these they, the sons of Japheth, spread themselves over the sea coasts of the countries of the nations, each with their language amongst the non-Adamic tribes. These were the sons of Ham in their tribes and languages, in the regions of the heathen. These are the sons of Shem by their tribes and by their languages, in their countries among the heathen." As Noah and his family members were the only surviving white people on the earth of pure blood after the flood, the only place for Canaan to have gotten a wife is from the non-white heathen in Ham's area. The way Ferrer Fenton translates Genesis 10, the flood couldn't have drowned all the people on the earth, as promoted in some circles. Now that we know from where Canaan could have gotten a wife, let's examine some archaeological proof concerning the Hittites, which were Canaan's descendants through Heth. I will now be quoting from Archaeology in the Bible by George A. Barton, Chapter 3, entitled The Hittites, pages 74 and 75. "The more our knowledge of the Hittites grows, the less simple seems the problem of their racial affinities. Some features of their speech clearly resemble features of the Indo-European family of languages, but other features would seem to denote Tartar affinities. Two distinct types of faces are there portrayed, One type has high cheekbones, oblique, slanting eyes, and wears a pigtail, like the people of Mongolia and China. The other has a clean-cut head and face which resembles somewhat the early Greeks. Among the Hittite allies, Semitic Amorites are also pictured. These have receding foreheads and projecting beards. The tablet on which the chronicle was written was inscribed in the Persian of late Babylonian period, but there is evidence that it was copied from an earlier original. If its statement is true, the Hittites had made their appearance in history and were prepared to mingle in that medley, a mingled and confused mass, of the races which occurred when the first dynasty of Babylon was overthrown. It may well be that Indo-Europeans, followed by Mongols, came about 2100 or 2000 BC into this region, or that the Mongols were there earlier and that the Indo-Europeans then came. In the resultant civilization, it would seem, from the information that we have, there was a mingling of the two races. End quote. For more information corroborating that the 10 nations mentioned in Genesis 15, 19 through 21 were such a mixed race as described here above, can be confirmed by the Peake's Commentary on the Bible, page 116. This group of nations includes the Hittites and the Canaanites, both having the curse of Noah on them, and any others with whom they intermarried. When the Israelites entered Canaan, they found there a very mixed population, generally designated by the term Amorite or Canaanite. End quote. In Genesis 15, 19 through 21 are listed 10 nations. They race mixed so much that in Deuteronomy 7, 1 and 2, there are only 7. The Kenites, Kenizzites, and Raphaims were completely absorbed by the other nations of this group, from which the quote-unquote Jews of today are extracted. As you can begin to see, the seed line of Cain was beginning to mix with the line of Canaan. Born of incest, and of course among this group were the Hittites and the Canaanites. The Adam Clark's Commentary on the Bible, abridged by Ralph Earle, page 38, has this to say. The Kenites. Here are 10 nations mentioned, though afterwards reckoned but 7. See Deuteronomy 7:1 and Acts 13:19. Probably, some of them which existed in Abram's time had been blended with others before the time of Moses, so that 7 only out of the 10 then remained. End quote. Now let's take a look at Genesis 15:19 and see what kind of a mixture of races were developing at this period of time in Palestine. In order to get a better portrayal, we will include verses 18 through 21. In the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites and the Kenizzites and the Kadmonites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Raphaim and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Girgashites and the Jebusites. One of these nations among the Canaanites were the Kenites, number 70:17. Which were descendants of Cain. Being that Cain was of the satanic seed line, he would infect his satanic blood among all these nations mentioned in this passage. Both the curse of Cain, Genesis 3:14, and the curse of Noah, Genesis 9:25, would come on these intermixed peoples. This is what it would take eventually 400 years to accomplish. There is one other nation among these 10 nations worth mentioning, the Kenizzites, as they are related to Esau, who married into the Hittites and Hivites, bringing the curse of Noah on his children by these two of his three wives. This particular nation would be from the union of Esau and his Hittite wife, Adah. Here is what Matthew Poole's Commentary on the Holy Bible, Volume 1, page 38, has to say about the Kenizzites. The Kenizzites, thought to be the Idumeans, who sprung from Kenaz of Esau's race, but but it seems not to agree with Deuteronomy 2:5, where God expressly said to the Israelites concerning the Idumeans, "I will give you none of their lands," etc. End quote. As Kenaz was only one of the 14 dukes of Edom, the statement about agreeing with Deuteronomy 2:5 is superfluous. The Kenazites are indeed of Esau. The Zondervan Pictorial Encyclopedia of the Bible, Volume 3, page 782, has this to say of Kenaz and the Kenazites. Kenaz, K-E-N-A-Z, singular form of the clan name, Kenazite, K-E-N-I-Z-Z-I-T-E, son of Eliphaz, and grandson of Esau. Genesis 36:11, 1 Chronicles 1:36. One of the chieftains of Edom, King James Version, dukes, Genesis 36:15 and 42, 1 Chronicles 1:53. End quote. Some may wonder why the Kenazites are named before the apparent time of Esau. It is a matter of predictive prophecy. You have to consider that Moses wrote all of this after the fact, and that all of the scriptures are not necessarily in chronological order. Later, all these groups mentioned in Genesis 15:19 through 21 became politically related to the composite group generally termed Judah. The Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, volume K through Q, page 6. Parallel with the daughters of Lot. The other famous case of incest in Scripture involved the daughters of Lot. To understand the similarity of this story, it is necessary to comprehend the background of the story of Lot. Lot was the son of Haran and the nephew of Abraham, Abram, who by the premature death of his father had already come into his inheritance. And when Abraham decided to go to the land of Canaan, Genesis 11:31, Lot united his substance, consisting chiefly in cattle, which was not then too large to prevent them from living together in the same encampment. Eventually, however, their possessions increased so greatly they were pressured to separate company, whereupon, after some quarreling among their respective shepherds, they agreed to part. Part of their problem came from the fact that not only did Abraham and Lot both need more land for their cattle to graze, but there were then also Canaanite shepherds in the land with whom to compete. Lot then took advantage of the generosity of his uncle as he demanded the better, more bountifully watered land by fixing his abode towards Sodom. This decision on Lot's part would prove in time his family's undoing. About 8 years after Lot and Abraham separated due to lack of land for their cattle, Lot was carried away prisoner by Chedorlaomer, along with the other residents of Sodom, whereupon Abraham raised an army and proceeded to rescue them. Abraham charged upon the enemies during the night while they were asleep, and chased them away so suddenly that they left behind everything, including their armor, and ran far into the mountains. In their camp, Abraham found his nephew, his wife, and his daughters with all their goods, safe and secure. This exploit secured for Abraham much renown and prestige among the Canaanites, which also should have procured for Lot the respect and gratitude of the people of Sodom, who by Abraham's effort delivered them from slavery and also restored for them their homes and belongings. This does not appear to have been the case. As I was preparing this lesson, I thought to myself, I wonder who Lot's wife was. Where did he get her? Surely he didn't get her from among these people of Sodom. As usual, I was looking up everything I could find on the subject of this lesson. I was reading in the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, volume K through Q, page 162. Although the narrative in Genesis 12, 10 through 20 does not explicitly state that Lot accompanied Abram and Sarai to Egypt, the three are named together upon their return to Palestine, Genesis 13:1. Moreover, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Genesis Apocryphon 20:11-33-34, has Lot not only accompanying Abram into Egypt, but also functioning as spokesman to Pharaoh's agent, lines 22-24, acquiring great possessions and obtaining a wife, line 34, end quote. This is becoming very interesting, for it was on this very same occasion that Abram and Sarah procured the Egyptian handmaiden Hagar, who in time became mother of Ishmael, who in turn had a daughter named Bashemeth, whom Esau married. So we know from this, Lot didn't marry among the people of Sodom. We will be getting back to this information as we get deeper into the study of Esau. You will remember that Lot, the nephew of Abraham, chose for himself the area of Sodom for his dwelling place, and lived there in the presence of very wicked and sexually perverted men, and their tolerance of evil became disastrous. You will recall also how Lot was carried away a prisoner when the city of Sodom was taken captive by its enemies, and how Lot was rescued by Abram. In spite of all that had happened, Lot returned to Sodom to take up his residence there once again, and he found himself there when the angels which had been at Abraham's tent came to Sodom. Two of the angels who had been entertained by Abraham went into Sodom looking for 10 just men that the city might be saved from destruction. But after searching, the only just men they could find was Lot himself. Lot brought the angels, who had the appearance of ordinary men, into his home and hosted them in the custom of that day, and treated them as honored guests with a delicious meal. No sooner had they finished their late evening meal than all the men of Sodom began to gather around Lot's home. For when the men of Sodom found there were strangers in Lot's house, men of a desirable physique, they assembled in front of the house, standing in the street, and tried every conceivable manner to entice them to come out to them. Lot knew the men of Sodom were wanting the men for sexual purposes, and offered his two young virgin daughters to the men of Sodom in place of the angels. Not having natural desires, the men of Sodom refused Lot his offer. After Lot did not yield to their desires, the men of Sodom tried to break Lot's door open and force their way into the house where the two young men were. Just before the men of Sodom broke Lot's door down to lay their hands on the two angels struck them instantly blind. In spite of being blind, the men of Sodom continued to feel their way around in the dark for the door and still tried to make entrance into Lot's house for the two angels who appeared as young men. At this point, the angels instructed Lot, "Round up immediately all the members of your family and get them out of this city. For this very night, this city, with all of its inhabitants, is going to fry." Knowing this, Lot proceeded to the homes where the two young men lived who were betrothed to his daughters and informed them of the peril they were in. But these, his two son-in-laws, the legal husbands-to-be of his daughters, refused his seemingly alarmist message, making only derisive replies. At last, as morning was approaching, the two angels urged Lot to hasten and get his wife and daughters to quickly depart so they would not be destroyed along with the city. But Lot was hesitant to leave the home he had made for himself in Sodom, along with anticipated future grandchildren through the marriages of his sons-in-law to his daughters, and all his belongings he had worked so hard to accumulate. So the two angels finally took hold on Lot, his two daughters, and his Egyptian wife, and literally dragged them from the city before it was destroyed. One of the angels then instructed Lot and his immediate family to escape for their lives, and whatever they did, not to look back behind them, also not to stop or linger in the plain, but climb up the mountains quickly so they would not be destroyed. As soon as Lot and his family were at a safe distance from Sodom, Yahweh caused a rain of fire to fall upon Sodom and the other cities of the plain. In addition to the fire came huge clouds of sulfur and smoke covering the entire plain, the cities being destroyed along with all the people in them. not a single man, woman, or child escaping this great inferno of destruction. Last of all, Lot's wife, lingering behind a bit to rest, looking back toward Sodom, found herself being pelted by millions of particles of salt and sulfur residue, coagulating around her until she became totally encrusted with it standing in her tracks. There is one other reason why Lot's wife looked back toward Sodom. It is recorded in the book of Jasher, chapter 29, verse 52, that she had other daughters who remained in Sodom. When we consider all the aspects of this story, it really is a sad one. Lot and his daughters became so frightened and terrified at all this destruction, and out of fear of further fire and brimstone, they decided not to stay at Zoar, a city in the plain that was spared by Yahweh to give them a place to reside, and they continued on up into the mountains and found a cave to live in. Lot ended up losing his wife and all his earthly possessions because of his decision to pitch his tent toward Sodom. After some time at this place in the mountain cave, the daughters of Lot became somewhat apprehensive that the family of their father should be lost for lack of male descendants, a situation which was considered a calamity of great magnitude in those days. From their vantage point, except for the city of Zoar, it appeared to them that the whole earth had been destroyed. In any event, the two daughters took it upon themselves to preserve Lot's seed. Dwelling with their father in this cave, through incestuous relations, the older daughter of Lot became pregnant by him and became the mother of the Moabites. Likewise, also, his youngest daughter became pregnant by him and became the mother of the Ammonites. Genesis 19:23-38. Like Canaan, whom Noah cursed, the children by Lot's incest would not prosper. Also like Canaan, the Moabites and the Ammonites were doomed to marry out of their race. For the next part of the story, we will go to the book of Jasher, chapter 19, verse 60. And after this, Lot and his two daughters went away from there, and he dwelt on the other side of the Jordan with his two daughters and their sons. And the sons of Lot grew up, and they went and took themselves wives from the land of Canaan, and they begat children, and they were fruitful and multiplied. When Lot's sons, Moab and Ammon, took wives of the Canaanites, they took upon themselves the curse of Noah upon Canaan. The curse of Noah upon Canaan didn't stop with him, but continued throughout all his descendants and all who married among them. These curses in Scripture are very serious. This is one of the best reasons in the world to prove that Ruth was not a Moabite. For if she were, the curse of Noah on Canaan would have fallen upon the genealogical line of our Redeemer. As you will remember when I quoted from the book Archaeology and the Bible by George A. Barton beforehand, one type has high cheekbones, oblique slanting eyes, and wears a pigtail, like the people of Mongolia and China. You may also remember that in lesson number 22 I mentioned, and while speaking of Ammonites, did you know the Japanese of today are the modern-day Ammonites? Alan Campbell wrote a small booklet called The Kings of the East to this fact. Also, Thomas E. Plant wrote a booklet, The Japanese, Who Are They?, on this very subject. In other words, it was Ammonites who attacked Pearl Harbor. If you look at the Japanese of today, you can see in them these same Mongolian features, especially the slanted eyes. You can tell by this that the Ammonites and Moabites mixed with these same Hittites of Bible times. From all this, we can have a better idea how the Hittite and Hivite wives of Esau appeared to Rebekah when she said, Genesis 27:46, I am weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. Therefore, a white serviceman bringing home a Japanese wife since World War II was bringing home a woman with the curse of Noah upon Canaan on her, notwithstanding the fact that she was and is not racially pure. How bad did things get in Sodom? To get an idea of just how bad things were getting in Sodom, I will quote the book of Jasher, chapter 18, verses 14 through 15. Actually, this is only just a small part of the story, for the things that were going on in Sodom were much greater than I am going to quote here. And in the time of rejoicing, they would all rise and lay hold of their neighbors' wives and some the virgin daughters of their neighbors. And they enjoyed them, and each man saw his wife and daughter in the hands of his neighbor, and did not say a word. And they did so from morning till night, and they afterward returned home, each man to his house, and each woman to her tent. So they always did four times a year. Jude 7. Even as Sodom and Gomorrah, and the cities about them, in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication, and going after strange flesh, are set forth for an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. 2 Peter 2:6, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemn them with an overthrow, making them an example unto those that after should live un-Yahweh-like. Genesis 19:24, then Yahweh rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone, which is sulfur, and fire from Yahweh out of heaven. Like the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah, the 10 nations making up the Canaanite nations, consisting of Cain's and Canaan's descendants, along with some Raphaim, were also a sexually perverted group of people. How then do we know that they were such? We know their lifestyles and what kind of people they were, as it is recorded in the 18th chapter of Leviticus, verses 24 and 25. Defile not ye yourselves in any of these things, for in all these things the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. And the land is defiled, therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it, and the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. We will not read the entire chapter, but just point out what kind of people they were according to this passage. The sons were having incest with their mothers. The fathers were having incest with their daughters. The brothers were having incest with their sisters. The fathers-in-law were having incest with their daughters-in-law. The nephews were having incest with their aunts. The uncles were having incest with their nieces. The brothers-in-law were having incest with their sisters-in-law. The sons-in-law were having incest with their mothers-in-law. The grandfathers were having incest with their granddaughters. The grandsons were having incest with their grandmothers. They were laying every man carnally with their neighbor's wife. They were also committing homosexuality. Now, if they were doing all of this, you know very well they were breeding interracially. Now, in this 400 years, this satanic seed spread throughout Canaan. Not only was the satanic seed of Cain involved here, but there was also the satanic seed of the Raphaim and the Edomites. The Raphaim were the children of the mixture of fallen angels who left their first estate and the daughters of men. And it is recorded that there were giants among them, mutants, with 6 toes on each foot and 6 fingers on each hand. This is why Yahweh gave Israel the commission to kill every single man, woman, and child among them. And he has never rescinded that commission. He has just put it on hold. End of Watchman's Teaching Letter number 24. Thank you for listening.